Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 8th of March, 2023, and this is Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast with me, David Taylor, and our online news editor, Phil Bishop, talking about some of the recent happenings in the UK construction industry. But we're British, Phil, so let's talk about the weather first. Have you got any snow up there in Kent?
We have a coating of wet snow. I don't think it's going to last very long. But it's quite pretty, but a bit wet.
It's enough to keep me indoors all day.
How about you? Nothing? Yeah, nothing in Devon?
Cold and wet and grey, but according to the BBC, it's going to get sunny later. Believe that when I see it. So, I'm staying here for the time being at least.
It's 8th of March, International Women's Day. I've got to be honest, I'm all for encouraging young women, girls, schoolgirls, thinking about their career, not to write off construction as a career path or a construction trade, anything that can be done to show that it is a viable, profitable, attractive career for them, and anything that can be done to make it a more attractive career for them is all good. And obviously, a lot of this International Women's Day thing, from the construction point of view, is about that. My problem with it, though, is the sense of bandwagon jumping. I've got all these press releases this week saying, International Women's Day, we've got a woman, can you write about her, please, and write about us? And it just seems a little bit, I don't know,
I think the thing is that when you designate a particular day or a week or a month, sometimes, you know, these initiatives to try and focus attention on a particular issue, is that people think, oh, International Women's Day, we ought to do something. And they haven't thought about it once for the previous 12 months, or previous 51 weeks at least. And all of a sudden, they think we've got to do something. And so we get deluged with press releases about the women working in particular organisations. And it feels like people are paying lip service, put it that way, paying lip service, because they've been led to believe that this is a day they should be thinking about this and they can forget it for the rest of the year. That's just the way I feel about it anyway.
Right, let's should move on.
Yeah, let's move on. Yeah, okay. So what else has caught your attention in the last couple of weeks, Phil?
Well, I think, following on a topic we have talked about, I think at least once, if not two or three times before, it is only fair to redress the balance. And this is the whole question of national highways filling in old, disused railway bridges by tipping concrete all over them. And we have backed the criticisms that have been made by all sorts of campaigners against the infilling of these disused railway bridges. And lo and behold, we have reported last week of a rather fabulous example of national highways not filling in an old disused railway bridge with concrete and aggregate, but actually restoring it rather beautifully and sympathetically and restoring it to its former wonder.
Yeah.
So I think we should say three cheers to national highways for this. Do you want to give a bit of context to what we're talking about?
Yeah. Well, this is it's a viaduct over the River Avon in up in the Scottish, is in the Scottish borders, West Lothian. It's on the Falkirk border. Yeah, 16 arch Victorian viaduct, and as you're right, it's a really magnificent structure. And they've spent I don't know how much. Do we know?
£2 million. It's not a huge project, but for £2 million to refurb a bridge is
But they've done, I mean, they've, I couldn't help feeling that reading this, they've gone batshit crazy because it's all about the bats, isn't it? I mean, they've they've used endoscopes to sort of probe into the structure to make sure there aren't any little bats hibernating in there. They've really sort of gone to town on this one. They've replaced these cast iron Patras plates with new facsimile ones, which are been made to replicate the originals. Done all sorts of fantastic work on it, and of course, and yeah, they, I say two cheers to them because, of course, it doesn't really take away some of the damage that they've done to, like, the Great Musgrave Bridge, which is a much smaller and less grand structure in Cumbria, I think, which they filled in underneath it with foam concrete and all sorts of crap and made it look really awful. And I think they were refused retrospective planning permission for that one. So they, you know, they blotted their copybook, but they've come up trumps with this. And so, yeah, I think we have to give them credit where credit is due.
For listeners who aren't familiar with this ongoing story, you might be wondering, why are National Highways looking after disused railway bridges?
And in Scotland, where they don't have any jurisdiction.
Well, that's a whole other kettle of eggs, and I'll come on to that in a sec. But as we've discussed before, when the railways were privatised, there's no way that the private sector wanted to take on these structures which are no longer carrying rail tracks. They're just wilderness or footpaths or nothing at all. And actually, in some cases, they do carry highways, but there's no longer a railway underneath them. And so the Department for Transport said, all right, National Highways, you understand bridges. You've got some civil engineers there. You take it on. And so it's this little sort of strange department within the roads business, National Highways, that's looking after old railway bridges, including, as you say, in Scotland. Now, we took the mick out of Highways England, as it was, for changing its name to National Highways when it wasn't national. Yeah. Well, more fool us, because clearly it does have a national remit.
Yeah.
But old railway bridges in Scotland.
Yeah. It's very interesting. I suppose if you wanted to be cynical, you'd say, well, why did they spend so much time and effort and money on this one, which is incidentally called the Westfield Viaduct. I think they've infilled about more than 50 bridges elsewhere in the UK, in England mainly. So there's one big, very prominent bridge, which they've been very kind to. But they've managed to infill about 50 others around the country.
A cynic might say, though, that the 50, it's actually 52 they've infilled so far.
Oh, is it right? Okay.
Those bridges are all quite diddy, probably all single arch.
Yeah, they were. Yeah.
And it's just a truckload of concrete that you can fill it in with. This 16-span viaduct, I don't know how high it is, but they're abseiling down it.
60 feet, I think.
60 metres high.
No, 60 feet.
60 feet. So that would take a huge amount of infilling to infill. It would probably cost more to infill it than it would to fix it.
Yeah, sure.
So
yeah.
It could be more a financial decision rather than an aesthetic decision or a heritage decision.
Yeah.
So maybe we shouldn't be too quick to pray, that National Highways are perhaps just saying, right, what's cheapest? Fill it in or fix it?
Yeah, or knock it down, of course. But of course, they wouldn't do that. That's the only other alternative, really. If it really is a dangerous structure and you can't infill it with concrete, then you've got to repair it or knock it down. Yeah. So they couldn't do that. I don't know if it's listed. I don't think it is, actually.
This one, it's got to be, hasn't it?
I would have thought so.
Just by looking at it, I mean, it might be a mini version, but not that mini, of Settle Carlisle railway viaduct. I can't remember what the viaduct and Settle Carlisle is called, but it's a huge spectacular thing. It's lovely.
Yeah, it must be. It must be listed.
Curiously, you called it the Westfield Viaduct, and that's what National Highways call it. But the HRE group, this campaign group who are fighting National Highways, the infilling program that they've got, they call it the Avon Viaduct because it goes over the... I didn't even know there was a river.
No, I didn't know there was a River Avon. It showed my ignorance.
Yeah. But, so what it's actually called, I don't know. But anyway.
I thought Westfield was a shopping centre in West London, but there you go. I mean, there are some other stories about historic or heritage structures in the news at the moment, and you ran a couple of stories last week in one after the other on a very similar topic. We're talking about the retrofit industry, which I find a confusing term. Explain what that is, Phil. Sorry, I put you on the spot there.
A year ago, the Construction Leadership Council published something called the National Retrofit Strategy. This is all driven by the whole net zero thing, mm-hmm. that most of us need to rip out our boilers, we need insulation, we need heat pumps fitted, double glazing, insulation, et cetera, et cetera. All this stuff to reduce our energy bills, reduce our carbon emissions, embedded carbon. There is a massive program of work that needs to be done on the nation's housing stock.
Yeah.
And the Federation of Master Builders, I think, has been particularly keen at driving this because its membership are the kind of small local building firms who will be doing this. And as any listener will know, as you and I have discussed, it's quite hard. I mean, I look at my house and I think, yep, I would like to do this trip. I'd like to do that trip. I don't really know where to start. I don't know who to trust. I don't know what the payback mm-hmm. is. It's going to be disruptive and costly. And, you know, if I'm going to move in the next 10 years, is it even worth it? But if I don't do it, will I be able to sell my house in 10
yes.
years time?
Yeah.
So we've all got this sort of, any homeowner's got this quandary going on. So there is this industry-wide strategy that's been produced, and they want the government to pick it up and run with it. The kind of, I mean, we've had the Green Deal and the boiler replacement scheme and all these other government initiatives which have, I was going to say, to a greater or less extent completely failed. I'm going to go further, they've completely failed.
And
last week there were two initiatives were launched, I guess. One is the creation of the National Retrofit Hub, mm-hmm. which is an initiative backed by Federation of Master Builders, Trustmark, the UK Green Building Council, and lots of mm-hmm. others. And they're basically trying to create a forum, I guess, for creating best practice for the industry to say, okay, this is how you make a 1930s semi. This is what you need to do to make it the best practice, to make it net zero,
yeah.
or these are the options. And to disseminate knowledge of best practice of how to do it. And in so doing, help create it used to be called home improvements. It's now retrofit.
Yeah. This is one of the things I find confusing. This word retrofit seems to have been hijacked. Retrofit just means adding something, but it's shorthand now for something completely specific.
Fixing up existing buildings.
Yes.
But it's fixing them up in a specific way. It's not putting in, you know, kitchen islands.
No.
It might be putting in, you know, modern bogs that don't use as much water when you flush them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the type that you have to flush four times instead of once.
Yeah.
So they work.
Yeah.
So it's all it's not mm. yes, I don't think it's just energy. I mean, I think water comes into it as well.
Sure.
I've got a one tap in my house is a little diddy mini sink that was put in a few years ago in the downstairs loo, and the water comes out so slowly, such a narrow pipe, so you don't waste water. And you think, oh, so you have to have it on for three times as long before you got the soap off your hands.
No, don't worry, you're saving the planet, Phil.
Very, very slowly.
Yeah. Yes.
Anyway, so the National Retrofit Hub, very good thing. I'm not quite sure how it fits in with the Construction Leadership Council's initiative. I mean, we've got the Federation of Master Builders involved in both, but there just seems to be a proliferation of these organisations. Mm. It's another one. And this is another one. National Retrofit Hub is an organisation that's bringing organisations together,
mm-hmm.
but then they all do. And you used to have a lot of fun, I think, when you had a column in Construction News many years ago with T42.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
All these different acronyms of
yeah.
Egan and Latham and whoever else sort of reforming the industry. And you just get so many of these groups forming, and they're all well-intentioned. Anyway, the other initiative in the retrofitting thing is related but different. Heritage bodies coming together. National Trust, Historic England, and some prominent owners of old property, well, National Trust and Historic England, the prominent owners of, owners of old property, but also landlords, Peabody, who own a lot of, obviously, old buildings in London, old blocks of flats and whatever, terraces. The Crown Estate, which we know has got lots of old buildings, and Grosvenor, which owns Westminster, basically, and other places. So these organisations come together to produce a report saying this is what we need to work on historic buildings. Because so far, and if you look at that construction leadership strategy document of last year, it might have even been 2 years ago. What's the date on it? June 2021, it's two years ago, beg your pardon. It was mostly looking at non-listed buildings, non-heritage, the easy wins, which are the majority of houses. But there are an awful lot of listed buildings, of old buildings, of buildings where it's not easy or not legal to start, you know, knocking holes in the wall and put a heat pump on the outside and this, that and the other. The heritage sector is saying that they've currently got 100,000 people working on historic buildings in the maintenance and looking after historic buildings. But they need another 105,000 new workers if we're going to get them upgraded to the way that net zero suggests they need to be upgraded by 2050. So in less than 30 years, we need to double the workforce on historic buildings, 14,500 more electricians, 14,300 more plumbers are needed just to work on historic buildings. I don't know what the definition of a historic building in this context is, but I'm going to say...
Well, this is it.
Pre-1910, maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, I think, 1919 seems to be the cut-off point. I think, I don't know why that should be. But, I mean, we notoriously have the oldest housing stock in Europe, don't we? I don't know why that is, but the UK or the British Isles, because I imagine that Ireland is much the same, has the oldest housing stock. The typical, I think 20% of houses in the UK, at least, are Victorian terraced houses. That accounts for a fifth of all, you know, homes, which is enormous. And I mean, I'm not sure you'd call those heritage houses necessarily. A lot of them have had an awful lot of work done to them anyway. But I assume that these people are calling for a strategy to improve the energy efficiency of that tranche of the housing stock and historic buildings, if you like. So, yeah, double glazing, insulation, that kind of thing, energy efficient appliances. I can see why they need so many people.
But it still doesn't get around the whole planning issue. So I've got neighbours who live in a lovely, beautiful Grade 2 listed house. I don't know, it's built 18 something, I guess. And it was built in a typical style that they were in those days, where the kitchen is tiny and dark and no windows, because you never went in. That's where the servants went. and they want to, like we all do, knock through their kitchen into another room, make a bigger kitchen that they can actually live in and sit in and so on. And the local planning authority said, nope, no way, you can't do it. You cannot expand, you can't extend outwards, you can't knock through. That's your kitchen, lump it. And so it'd be wrong to say it's not fit for modern life, but it's not in keeping with modern life.
No.
And I think at some point we're going to have to be a little bit more flexible and about what we're allowed to do to listed buildings, particularly with regard to net zero. If they're going to have, you know, have a heat pump put in, there's going to have to be some holes drilled in the walls.
Sure. Yeah, there's no point putting in something like an air source heat pump if you've got a house that's leaking heat like a sieve, because a heat pump won't do it. I mean, if you've got a gas boiler, you can whack up the temperature, burn loads of gas and get a livable temperature. You couldn't do that with a heat pump. I think with the whole issue of listed buildings, I mean, that's a whole new can of worms, really. But a lot of it, I think, depends on the individual officer in your planning department, because they have an enormous amount of power. And I've heard stories about really, well, I've encountered really good conservation officers at my, in my local authority, and also pretty inflexible ones who, you know, wield the power. They get, you know, it goes to their heads. I've got a friend who works as an architect on old buildings up in the Midlands, who had a real tussle with the local conservation officer because he was designing a garden shed for somebody in a building in Leicestershire, and he wanted to build it with in local brick.
Hang on, someone employed an architect to design a garden shed.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they wanted a nice brick built garden shed.
Okay, that's more than a garden shed.
Yeah. Well, yes,
that's a granny flat.
Well, I don't know how big it was, but the thing was, it was in a, you know, one of these chocolate box villages, and so he designed this shed using local brick and with a corrugated iron roof. And the local planning officer said, no, you can't do that. The roof has to be oak shingles. And he pointed out there wasn't a single building with oak shingles within a radius of about 100 miles. And yet in the back of every garden was a shed with a corrugated iron roof on it. And the heritage officer wouldn't have it, you know. So that's just an extreme example. So I think the whole idea, there are lots of misconceptions about listings. People think that because they read a document on the English Heritage website, it mentions certain architectural characteristics of a building. Those are the protected characteristics. It's not true. Everything within the curtilage of the property is listed by default. You can't list everything. But that's what it is, everything within the curtilage. And the whole idea of listed buildings is to try and preserve the fabric for posterity. But it has to be pragmatic, because if you've got a house, somebody's got to live in it. You can't have it with a beaten earth floor and, yes, you know, stuff like that. You need to make it livable within, you know, the expectations of modern life. And so there,
I think maintaining the character should be enough rather, yes, than maintaining the fabric.
Well, yeah. Yeah. Maintaining the character is probably more important. I once owned a listed building which had had some awful things done to it before I ever got my hands on it. And I discovered that there was in the dining room, there was a big inglenook and a bread oven behind a bricked up, well, it had been bricked up, and a cast iron Victorian fireplace had been put in there. The fireplace was mostly rusted away anyway. And I wanted to open it up and, you know, sort of reinstall the inglenook and the bread oven. And I wasn't allowed to do it because this particular planning officer wouldn't let me do it. And actually, somebody said, well, you know, you've got to ask yourself why they bricked up in the first place. And it probably was, getting back to the retrofit business, that all the heat in the room was going straight up the chimney and out of the house. So,
yeah,
you know, it's swings and roundabouts, I suppose. But yeah, this whole retrofit idea is interesting. In fact,
but it's the,
go on.
Again, but the heat pump thing, I mean, you're not even allowed, it doesn't matter anymore. I don't think people use satellite dishes now. It all comes down broadband. But
yeah, down a wire, yeah.
Do you remember if you lived in the conservation area, all sorts of places had restrictions on if you could put up a satellite dish or not if you lived in, yes, chocolate box villages? Yeah. No satellite dishes. Now, how is that? Mm-hmm. How are they going to then allow? You can't have a satellite dish, but you can have this huge, great heat pump fan thing on your,
yes,
backwards refrigerator,
yeah,
tacked onto the side of your house.
Well, again, I suppose each case has to be considered on its merits, and once more, it comes down to the prejudices of the local conservation officer. I think that obviously the local authorities have their own policies on these things. And I'm sure that if your local authority wants to encourage people to put in renewable energy, then they will make an exception for an air source heat pump on the side of an old, you know, Victorian or Edwardian house. And I think you've got to make all the other changes. So you've got to insulate your floors and your walls and your roof spaces, but you've got to look at it holistically. You can't just put a heat pump on an old building and expect it to work adequately.
True. But I think the fact that, as we were saying, National Trust, Historic England, Crown Estate, Grosvenor and Peabody have come together in this push for highlighting the need, I suppose, to get a program together for retrofitting heritage buildings, improving heritage buildings, indicates that if they do realise that we need to be a bit more pragmatic about what we do to old buildings, that there's going to have to be an element of compromise.
Yes, I think that's probably true. Well, all right then. Well, I think I'm sure we'll return to the topic of heritage buildings and all this retrofit business in future. It'll be worth us keeping our eyes on that. But there are other problems, of course, affecting the industry, and we're not just talking about wrecking old buildings, but wrecking the environment as well. And there's a very interesting story on the website, which I think you posted. Was it this week or last week, Phil, about a pollution incident?
Yes. The incident itself happened 2019 it happened. This is on the East Midlands Gateway to the big logistics development near Kegworth. And the contractor was Winvic, who's built an awful lot of these developments. And you've done a couple of pieces in the magazine as well. I know you report a lot on Winvic. Is at the cutting edge of a lot of tech that used in these developments. And it's generally a good company that doesn't take shortcuts. So it's a bit surprising to get see the Environment Agency posting a press release about how they fine them £160,000 plus 26 grand costs because they contaminated a nearby stream, Hemington Brook. A drain blocker failed during heavy rainfall, and Hemington Brook just was loads of crappy discharge, basically, came out, and I don't know how many fish died, but it was had potential to do lots of fish damage, and it was all a mess. And it's the sort of thing that contractors should not be doing, of course. And so I basically reported on the facts as presented by the Environment Agency, which, to all intents and purposes, Winvic had done something wrong and been found, and yeah, they admitted it.
It looks like a classic case, doesn't it, Phil? It looks like a classic case of a builder, washing polluted, mud-laden water into a local watercourse. But it's far more nuanced than that. I think this is the interesting thing about it.
I sent an email to Winvic, who've got a fabulously effective PR person who looks after them, expecting just given the opportunity to say, we take the environment very seriously and we will endeavour not to do it again.
Kind
of thing, which is normally what you get. And actually, what I got was kind of an apology of saying, look, sorry about this, but we do have a response. It's rather long. And I said, well, not a problem. If it's interesting, I'll post it all, because unlike in the days of producing magazines and newspapers where you've only got a 6-inch column of the page that you could have to squeeze everything in, online you've got space to tell the full story. So I put the whole thing in, and I don't think we could do any better than just read out Winvic's response. And can I invite you to read that out, David?
Yeah, if you'll give me a couple of minutes to find it. Okay, yeah. A Winvic spokesman said, okay, quote, "We acknowledge and regret the discharge of surface water containing Mercia mudstone," which is a mineral I'd never heard of, "Mercia mudstone held in the East Midlands Gateway site's ponds into Hemington Brook in August 2019. Whilst industry defined and agreed best practice mitigation measures were in place at the site, a number of factors combined to leave Winvic, in the words of the court, between a rock and a hard place." And it continues, "Due to the acknowledged heaviest period of rainfall in the area since records began, significant volumes of water built up in the approved siltation ponds on the site. This unforeseen event unfortunately attracted large numbers of migrating birds, which presented a very real and potentially fatal risk of a bird strike at the adjacent East Midlands Airport, conflicting with the requirement from the Environment Agency to hold and clean water prior to discharge. The decision was therefore taken to discharge water from the ponds in order to avoid the possibility of a more catastrophic event occurring, hence the rock and a hard place comment. However, we accept that in doing so, water containing suspended solids of Mercia mudstone was discharged into Hemington Brook. Shall I carry on? There's a bit more. I mean, I think that's the nub of it, isn't it? The fact that they were...
Yeah, it is. they're saying they were doing the whole job was all done with the full, you know, risk assessments, environmental assessments, yeah. And they're working closely with the environment agency. They'd implemented additional measures for treating the water, managing site runoff before the incident, all endorsed by the environment agency. They'd done everything by the book. And suddenly something comes along and you think, we're going to make a plane crash. What do we do?
Yeah, exactly.
And
completely, I mean, you couldn't really have foreseen that. I don't think, no, unless you had a bird expert.
This is assuming this response is a fair and accurate response.
Sure.
And I choose not to doubt it. I trust them, I think.
Yeah.
So, you know, what do you do? And it's like so many of these, this isn't health and safety, this is pollution, but it's in that kind of that realm.
Mm.
And you get cases where you often get people in breach of health and safety law because there actually was no alternative. And they've used their common sense and they thought, well, we haven't got a crane, but we need to lift this thing up.
Mm-hmm.
And this excavator's, you know, if you tie a hook to the excavator, we can lift this boulder up using the excavator. We're not supposed to. It's not designed for lifting.
Mm-hmm.
But it's safer than, you know, trying to get 32 people around it and push it that way. So you'll often get on construction sites things which you have been unable to foresee.
Mm.
The excavator lifting example isn't a good one. But if you use your initiative to choose the lesser of two evils,
yeah,
you can still get punished for it.
Yeah, we are giving Winvic the benefit of the doubt here because we've only got their word for it. But I mean, clearly, if they were warned by, I don't know, the Civil Aviation Authority, for example, that you've got to do something about these birds, somebody had
could
to
have
say,
just shot them.
Do we shoot loads of birds or suffocate loads of fish? I don't know. Actually, no, I'm not sure fish were affected. They do mention invertebrates here, but anyway, it was if it really was a choice between polluting a small stream and possibly causing an air crash, I think that everybody would have made the same decision in these circumstances.
So that fine seems quite high in the context of that, doesn't it? I mean, the fact that they're guilty, they should be fined, but 160 grand?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that is a very big project. I mean, it would have been petty cash for...
Not for Winvic, maybe for the client.
Oh, for the client, yeah, yeah. No, Winvic had to pay the fine, of course. Yeah, a fair amount of money. I don't know. Was there a third way? Was there another alternative? Yeah, maybe they could have... You know, got somebody with a, you know, a falcon to keep the birds off the...
A cat.
Or a cat. Yeah, or maybe the local wildfowling club. Yeah, as you say, just shot them all. Could they have foreseen that they'd have dozens of geese homing in on their siltation ponds? Probably not. I mean, I wouldn't have expected that. I think probably a unique... incident and not something that you could have planned for. They do say, I mean, in their statement, that the EMG site was fully in accordance with the development consent order granted by the Secretary of State, and more specifically, fully complied with the recommendations within the Construction Management Framework Plan and Construction Industry Research and Information Association guidance. So they're saying, look, we followed the rules to the letter. So, you know, it's not our fault, Gov, and you've got to have some sympathy for that. I think probably they did really all they could do.
Yeah, and I think it's an interesting tale.
Yeah.
Having said that, if they'd dumped all that crap in my local stream,
yeah,
I probably wouldn't have been safe.
Well, you don't want to blame the other thing is that I think that probably this is a contractor who's been found guilty of polluting a stream. But I watched a programme recently with Paul Whitehouse, you know, from the Fast Show, and you know, a keen angler. I watched this week actually, and I don't know whether
he had Fergal Sharkey on it. I read about
it. That's right, he did. All about what the water companies are doing, and you know. In fact, we have a feature coming up in the next issue of the magazine about what the water companies are doing to rivers, in particularly in the Oxford area, in the Thames catchment area. And they're the ones who are really causing widespread pollution. And that is something which is could entirely be foreseen. They aren't investing enough money. They're paying their... Well, then actually, they're saying they're not paying their shareholders the dividends that their shareholders would like, and they are investing. But the point is they're not really investing enough. And so you've got these combined sewage overflows, which are probably the fastest selling precast concrete item on the market at the moment.
Really?
Well, I get press releases all the time from people about their new CSO, and people are installing them left, right, and centre, because what happens is that these... CSOs, they are designed to discharge into local watercourses untreated sewage in incidents of high rainfall, when the sewage system cannot cope with the volume of runoff. So a mixture of rainwater runoff and raw sewage gets tipped into the local river. We know we have a lot of floods these days. You know, every year we have a big flood incident somewhere. So the infrastructure isn't up to it, and the water companies aren't doing enough to improve the infrastructure to cope with it. They're the ones doing who we should be looking at when it comes to polluting the rivers, not the contractors necessarily.
But the strange catch 22, politicians are saying that the water companies aren't being fined enough. And the problem is that it's cheaper for the water companies just to pay the fines than it is to invest in the infrastructure to stop the problem happening. So the politician's solution is, right, we're going to dish unlimited fines. We're going to fine Thames Water £500 million. But if you do that, if you make the fine so expensive that it's cheaper to build,
they can't spend the money.
They'll have no money left
to
spend on the infrastructure because they've got to pay these bloody fines. So it's squaring that circle.
Maybe they should follow the example of, you know, sort of corporate manslaughter cases and actually make individuals personally responsible for this.
That would
certainly focus people's minds on what they're doing. Make individuals
public floggings for water company bosses.
Bring back the stocks,
or make them swim in their own damn rivers.
Well, yes, yeah. No, that would be pretty medieval. I don't think we should do that. But fine individuals, or make them personally responsible for things like this, and not be able to hide behind their employer or their organisation.
Then what would happen is that no one would want to work for a water company unless they are paid even more than they are already. Every action has a reaction, David. That's the trouble.
That's true. I mean, we do have these AMPs, these regular investment programs, don't we? Where these private utilities are actually required to invest. You know, you have these investment periods where they're, and that is, you know, those systems are set up to try and tackle this problem. Maybe we ought to look at revisiting those and perhaps rethinking them, the way they work, the way they're set up.
You don't think nationalisation's the answer then?
I'm personally in favour of nationalisation in certain circumstances, not without reservation. But I think the water sector is one example of where privatisation didn't work as well as it was intended. Do you remember when water was one of the first sort of national utilities to be privatised by, was it by the Thatcher government?
No, it wasn't. Gas. Tell Sid, gas was long before that. Electricity was before that.
Oh, was it?
No, water was quite late because of the concept that water is free, and then it had to explain to people that, no, we're not privatising water, we're privatising water treatment industry.
Yeah, okay.
Which is, you know, it's a different thing. Because Victorian infrastructure was crumbling and so on. Mm. And we wouldn't have, I don't think the public sector could have built the Thames Tideway super sewer, but there's no reason why they couldn't have used the same model in the public sector, going to the bond market.
But the way privatisation was sold to the public was that you can own a share of your gas utility, your electricity company, water company, and that didn't happen. It was bought up by the pension funds and the foreign government wealth funds, stuff like that. Big organisations bought into it, not individuals, and so we weren't reaping the benefit as
having said that, well, pension funds are the aggregation of individuals.
Okay. Yeah.
A pension fund is simply a representative organisation for lots and lots of people who've taken out an ISA, for example.
Yeah, actually we probably own part of our water companies, Phil, or somebody else's water companies, because I've got a private pension. I don't know where it's invested.
Right. So that's pollution. We're nearly out of time. We probably are out of time. But I just wanted to, before we go, there are three boardroom stories. I mentioned one of these to you, but I think they're all just worth flagging up to say that we find these interesting. The first one is the takeover of Jewson's has the High Street Builders Merchant. We reported last year that Saint-Gobain had done a deal to sell its UK building materials distribution business to a Danish outfit called Stark Group, S-T-A-R-K, which, if memory serves, is Iron Man's name, isn't it? Tony Stark?
I have no idea.
I don't think this is Tony Stark, but Denmark Stark Group.
Okay.
Stark Group is actually on the rise because it was itself taken over by a private equity group, CVC Capital Partners, a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so that CVC Capital Partners say, right, builders, we've discussed before about consolidation in the builders merchant builders merchant sector. So they've got all this stuff in Scandinavia, Stark, and now they've moved into the UK by taking over Saint-Gobain's building distribution business, £740 million deal, and that includes primarily 600 Jewson's, but also various other smaller groups, International Timber,
okay.
Gibbs and Dandy, I've never heard of them,
but they've
got 28 branches. Other people. But what's most interesting to me, I think, of this is that they have brought in to run it, the Danes, a guy called John Carter. John Carter, not from Mars, but John Carter from Travis Perkins, who retired from Travis Perkins a couple of years ago after 40 years there, including something like, I don't know, he was 12 years on the board. He was chief operating officer at Travis Perkins and then chief executive for 5 years or so at Travis Perkins. And he's come back.
But to his biggest rival.
yeah. So that's good to see someone who you think, who can we get? Oh, I know, the guy that ran Travis Perkins. And I still think he's not yet 60, John Carter. So he's, you know. He's
got plenty of mileage left in him.
Yeah. So I think that was interesting, anyway, to see John Carter coming back to run that group. The second boardroom story was just this morning, Lang O'Rourke, or yesterday evening, and Lang O'Rourke announced that Cathal O'Rourke, the son of majority owner and chief executive Ray O'Rourke, is moving back from Australia to become chief operating officer of the whole group. Cathal O'Rourke had been, I don't know the term is managing director, but head of the Australia business.
Right.
Lang O'Rourke got,
they got a lot of activities
business
out there,
over in Australia. Yeah. And he's now coming over to be Group Chief Operating Officer, which kind of the obvious thought that one would have reading this is, oh, well, he's being groomed to become Chief Executive. It's his father's and uncle's company. That all makes sense. But it was only last year when they brought in this guy, Seamus French, from Aggregate Industries, to as Chief Executive Designate at Lang O'Rourke. And then 10 months later... big change of mind, and Ray O'Rourke said, "Actually, I'm not going to give you my business. I'm going to stay here as chief executive." And Seamus French left, and Ray O'Rourke said he's going to stay chief executive at least until April 2024. Mm. So, and he'll be 77 by then. And I think Ray O'Rourke's the kind of person that probably never particularly wants to retire. So anyway, whether Cathal O'Rourke is being set to take over running the business in a couple of years' time, or whether Ray O'Rourke wanted to see his new grandchild. Cathal O'Rourke, he said in the announcement, had just come off paternity leave, a new father. And so come home with partner and child back to UK, to sunny Dartford, which is a lot like Australia in so many ways. There's a bridge in Dartford. There's a bridge in Australia.
Yeah, I think that's probably,
Sydney Harbour Bridge, a bit like the Dartford Bridge. About the only comparison I can think of.
The Heath is like the Outback, apparently.
the third boredom story is perhaps one for another day when we know what's really going on. But Inland Homes. In fact, I just suggest you Google Inland Homes. Look up the latest news there. It's the whole board has quit, basically. leaving only the finance director. But the articles of the company say you're not allowed only one director. The company has to, I don't know, has to disintegrate or something, self-destruct if it's only got one director. It's got to be two directors. So the non-exec chairman who said, I quit, Simon Bennett, he's agreed to stay on for 2 weeks until they can find one other director to take his place on the board. And that was 6 days ago. So it's going to be next week. The expectation is, they're saying that they're going to bring back Stephen Wicks, who retired. And he's another, I think he's also, forgive me if I've got your age wrong, but I think he's about 70 odd. So he'd put a shift in before retiring last year. So he's going to come back. But it sounds a bit of a bastard case. They've had this, you know, the pre-tax loss of 91 million they're expecting to report when they do eventually report their financial results. And it's a company in some interesting disarray.
Yeah, definitely.
So we'll return to that one when we know what's happening.
If they couldn't get the required second director, would they have to call in the administrators or something? Would the company just wind up?
It means the shares would have to be suspended from the stock market. It's AIM listed, and how long shares be suspended? I don't know. But it says it doesn't expect that to be the scenario. It expects to be able to get Stephen Wicks on board as soon as they've done the statutory due diligence. I don't know why you need due diligence checks for the guy that actually founded the company who's been running it for X number of years. I mean, if it was good enough for all those years, it's clearly good enough now.
Yeah, should be.
Right, I have nothing to add. Anything more from you, David? You got the magazine? Actually, I had my... You say the magazine's coming out. It landed on my doormat yesterday morning.
Oh, did it? Well, I haven't had my copy.
Very healthy, it looks too.
Good. Yeah, I mean, it's got some interesting stuff in there. As I say, we've got a piece about the water industry and about the lack of investment in water infrastructure. Talking about retrofitting, there's also a big feature about the... Salford University's Energy House 2.0, which is this big sort of full scale test bed that they've got there. They've got two houses built inside a building, and the building they're built inside is climate controlled, and they can freeze it, they can bake it, they can blow snow, ice, and all the rest of it. But the Energy House 1, which was the original, was actually a retrofit house. They built, it's still there and still being used. It was built as a facsimile of a typical Edwardian terraced house. And it's being used to test retrofit technologies to improve its energy performance. So that's an interesting feature. Yeah, we've got some good stuff.
You've also got a big piece on, which we talked about last time, reinforced autoclaved aerated concrete panels.
Yes, we've got a bit on that.
These concrete panel beams which are failing in schools and hospitals around the country.
Yes.
So that's probably a more coherent, because being journalists, we're better at writing than talking, a more coherent explanation to people of what it's all about than what we were trying to convey last time.
Probably. Right, are we done then, Phil? Are we going to say goodbye?
I think we are. Let's say goodbye. Thank you, everyone, once again, for listening to David and myself. You can, as always, get in touch with us to tell us what we're wrong about, podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. If you have come across this by accident, you can subscribe to this podcast. I don't think subscribe is the right word, because that implies a fee. We are absolutely free. You get what you pay for, of course, but we are free from any of your usual podcast sources. Sign up. And if you're with Apple or anywhere that has a... Leave us a review. Tell people how whatever we are. And we'll be back again in 2 weeks' time. So thank you and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.